Thinking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben. Welcome back. This is going to be a solo episode today. Just some quick thoughts to get out of the way on the NBA playoffs. Cody is still busy on father duty. We'll have him back next week to dive into some of these second round series. But I wanted to catalog for posterity the best players of the first round. And I think the way I want to do this is with first team and second team. So we'll do like an all-NBA first team, all-NBA second team to basically get roughly the 10 best players of the first round. And as I said, I want to do this for posterity to put a stake in the ground. But I'm also always interested and have talked about over the years, how do we evaluate players in small samples? Like, how do we look at the game last night? Oh my God, the game last night, the Knicks and the 76ers and that series. And just as an aside, one of the most exciting series of the century, probably. Every game was both incredibly stressful and incredibly entertaining, and almost all of them went down to the wire. The Knicks had a, what, 5 or 6 point swing comeback at the very end of a game on the steal. It was a game two where they had the steal and the controversial turnover on Maxey down at the end, and then another three off the offensive rebound to score like 5 or 6 points in 20 seconds that swung that game back to them. And it was 2-0 going back to Philly instead of 1-1. Then Maxey in game five with the seven points in the final 28, 30 seconds of the game there. That one went into overtime. Last night's game was crazy and came right down to the wire. Technically came down to the final shot. So, incredible series. How do you judge Jalen Brunson's performance in that series? How do you judge Joel Embiid's performance in that series or Tyrese Maxey's performance in that series? It was also a weird series in that it was a first-round series played at a second- or third-round level, meaning Philadelphia with Embiid, even though he wasn't 100%, we'll talk about that and what that means and how to make sense of that. He was good enough that the 76ers and the Knicks, at least to me, look clearly like the second and third best team in the Eastern Conference. So they're playing in the first round because Embiid misses half the season. That pushes Philly down to the play-in game. So you get a second or third round quality series that is just back and forth like that in that round. Whereas a team like the Celtics, they're playing a play-in team in Miami that you could argue is weaker than a play-in team because of the injuries they sustained. And of course, we're specifically thinking about Jimmy Butler here. Although I think they had more injuries as well as the series unfolded. But that team was that team that the Heat fielded and put on the floor a top, 15 team in the NBA? It doesn't seem like it to me. I think you could make an argument that there were other teams that weren't in that position or didn't even make the final bracket from the play-in that would have put up a better fight against the Celtics. So the goal here today is to catalog all that, put some of it in perspective, and just put a stake in the ground and say, who are the best players in the first round? Let's start, no more further ado. If we can talk about the next series and some of that, we'll get there. But Cody will be back, as I said, and we'll dive into that in detail if you're looking for a second round analysis as the weekend unfolds here. I will try to be a little bit forward facing, but we'll see what we get to. I want to start with the first team. The first guy I penciled in that is basically a no-brainer is Nikola Jokic of the Denver Nuggets. It actually wasn't his best series. He had a weird game five where you're like, man, you're making turnovers or throwing turnovers that I rarely see you throw. You're missing passes. You're missing shots that you normally make. Was it a terrible defensive series? No, I don't think it was a terrible defensive series. But even in that game five, there were certain situations where he's weak in space and the Lakers were able to get him in transition in space. So it wasn't like this hallmark Nikola Jokic series. That's the point. And yet, I still think he was as good, if not better, than anyone throughout the totality of the first round. If you look at our metrics on our board for Patreon subscribers, patreon.com/thinkingbasketball, he once again led the league by a comfortable margin in first round box plus minus. So just looking at that box score snapshot in the context of his team and what we know about his scoring and his passing and his playmaking and some inferences about his shooting and his spacing. And then, as always, when you start to take into account the plus minus data, very small sample and very hard to do in a single playoff series. But in this case, the point of the podcast is I'm trying to marry this to the beats of the actual series, what actually happened in the series, what happened strategically in the series, the kind of pressure a player put on the defense in the series when he was on the court versus when he was off the court. And as always, that was those were good marks for Nikola Jokic. He averaged 26 points on true shooting percentage that was 11% ahead of what the Lakers allowed on defense in the regular season. Interestingly enough, they played 9 games in the playoffs in the last 2 years. Last year's 4-game sweep was a decently competitive series. And for a sweep, it was a fairly to very competitive series. This year, they play the 5 games, and none of the Nuggets indicators with their starting lineups or point differential or anything like that, again, suggest a dominant series victory. So Jokic on the court in the entire series was plus 4 per 100 possessions. In a 5-game series, that might be, what, 350, 400 possessions. So you're outscoring a team over the course of 5 games by like 20 points with your best player on the court. Jamal Murray did not have the greatest series overall. He started the series and was struggling with his shot early in the series, but he made 2 huge shots down the stretch, game 2 takeover, game 4 as well. And you swing those games and it's 4-1 Denver instead of 3-2 LA. That's the difference in the series. So even with all that, I'm going to put Jokic here on my first team, my all first round first team. Let's call it that. All first round first team. Who else? Who else can I pencil in pretty immediately? Anthony Edwards was probably the next player I felt really comfortable penciling into this position. We've talked about it, I think, in the last episode and certainly in the video we did on the Timberwolves on the YouTube channel. He's a very good defender right now. How good, you know, is he peak playoff Jason Tatum, like switching on guys and protecting the rim and blowing up big forwards? I'm not ready to go there yet, but I'm in a holding period now where I know what he can do on certain possessions defensively when he dials it up. He does have, because of his athleticism, some ability to come over and make plays at the rim. In game 4 in the closing game in Phoenix, the sweep of the first round, down the stretch just had an incredible save block rotating over from the baseline at the last second. I can't remember. It might have been on Bradley Beal. I can't remember who was shooting at the rim. But, I mean, you add those things in with some of the hawkish man defense, the fact that obviously with his physical attributes and tools, he can switch on different players and you can, you don't deploy him like, hey, Jaden McDaniels, you're a defensive specialist, go take away their best offensive player. But he's part of that mix. When he ends up in it, when someone's on the bench for spurts in the game, he can go guard them. And it's really fantastic. And so you take all that and you say, he's playing good defense. I'm not sure how good the defense was. It's a 4-game sample, but it was good defense. And then you look at the offense. The dude averaged 30 points per 75 on plus 7% true shooting in the series. The decision-making is still something we want to see come along in the future, but he's not even 23 years old yet. Down the stretch of some of those games, game 4 is fresh in my mind. The smart, simple plays to move the ball when doubled, feel pressure. And you don't have to make the perfect pass across the court or, you know, manipulate the defense and find a layup with your big man. But just feeling, hey, the defense is sending a second defender to my side as I isolate. Let me swing it to Mike Conley. Mike Conley swings it to Karl-Anthony Towns. He swings it to the corner. You get an open 3. So creating offense for others that way. I thought the totality of his series was a really good offensive centerpiece and really good defense. That is fantastic quality basketball. It's like MVP quality basketball to me. So Anthony Edwards was the second guy that was an easy pencil in, or pen. I mean, I'm penning it in. What am I saying? Every year, people ask me about working in basketball professionally, or even how we add people to the Thinking Basketball team. And Sports Business Classroom is one of my go-to answers. And let me tell you why. It's professional, hands-on teaching from industry leaders and experts that sets you up to work in basketball. Alumni have gone on to work for multiple NBA teams, major media outlets like The Athletic, Clutch Sports, and more. This year's new lead instructor is ESPN's Bobby Marks, and the curriculum covers scouting, analytics, media, and the salary cap. The program is a six-day immersive experience that takes place July 14th to 20th in Las Vegas during Summer League. And if you use the code THINKINGBASKETBALL at signup, you get $300 off your registration. Interest right now is at an all-time high and space is limited, so check it out at sportsbusinessclassroom.com if you're interested, and use that signup code THINKINGBASKETBALL for $300 off.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So, Jokic, Anthony Edwards, then it starts to get interesting in terms of teasing out, you know, the last three spots among probably five candidates for me. And so if you want to get your nasty grams queued up and complain about this stuff, just keep that in mind, that this is kind of, you know, a gray area. Some of these guys could make it. Some of these guys could not make it. But I don't want to get bogged down on that and make it an impossible exercise like some of these ranking exercises that we undergo are. Instead, I want to look at it and say, for the record, here's what I was seeing in this round of the playoffs. Let's put it in stone. If you're fringe second team or you make the second team versus first team, I'm not going to get too worried about splitting those hairs. And so the next guy for me to discuss here is LeBron James. And I don't know if LeBron James could play as well as he played in this series over four playoff series or three playoff series or whatever it is at his age. But last year he had the thing with his foot and he played very well. And I thought this season without that, he was moving better and was able to make certain plays at the basket on offense and then even defensively that he couldn't really make last year. And just having that communication and intelligence on the court provides so much value on the defensive end. Did he have the tools, or is Denver the kind of opponent that can change the course of, you know, a 10-minute stretch in the fourth quarter of a key game? It's not. And a lot of that is the Nuggets, and some of that is his age and limitations and whatnot with him. But I still liked a certain amount of the defensive component. And then offensively, is he a player who, over the course of a series, can just get out of my way, 8-minute stretch, do absolutely everything, heliocentric? Not quite, but man, some of those possessions down the stretch, when they needed a three, when they needed a bucket, when they needed a post up, when they needed a pick and roll, when they needed him to screen and then move into some other action, it was really impressive. It's really good. And when you stack it up to the rest of the players in the first round and how well they played, I think LeBron in our box model that I was alluding to earlier, yes, just looking it up now, he was second in the first round. As of recording this, they're is still the 4-5 series in the East and the 4-5 series in the West that need to conclude. The 4-5 series in the East, that's the NBA TV Cody special. That's the Mavs and, sorry, that's the Cavs and the Magic. That's a fun one for us around here because we love watching the Magic, and the Cavs have been such an interesting team, although they've certainly had struggles, to say the least, in the last couple months. So that series is weird because it exists in this kind of ether where in the future, who's going to look back and say, you know, let's track the progress of how these guys played in the first round. Maybe a player like Donovan Mitchell, depending on where he goes or how people defend him. Maybe someone like Evan Mobley, if he can grow and take a step forward. And then on the Orlando side, you know, as listeners know, I am just not a huge believer in Paolo Banchero's offensive sort of ceiling as a centerpiece. I much prefer him as a secondary or tertiary offensive player and someone who could continue to develop his defensive versatility. But if you tune into the series right now, it's the same thing with the Magic. Paolo is having to do or deciding to do stuff in games where he does a ton of heavy lifting, ton of isolation. Sometimes he makes a bunch of shots. Sometimes it's a ton of turnovers. I think he's in the second percentile in turnovers in the first round of the of all players in the playoffs, the way we calculate turnover percentage. So maybe that, but the rest of the Magic, who are really young and really exciting, the rest of the Magic to me are defensive guys, mostly defensive effort, hustle, 3-and-D shooting, secondary creation, Franz Wagner, get out in transition, stuff like that. And they're doing a nice job of it, especially in the games they can hit threes and turn you over. But I don't know someone from a series like that. I don't know if there's someone that we're really going to talk about there. The Clippers-Mavs series, we will discuss players from. I just want to, you know, clarify that if you're listening to this in the future, they've only played 5 games in the series. Kawhi seems to be shut down for the series. That seems to put a hard cap on what the Clippers can do offensively. So I do want to talk about a few guys from that, but if something radical were to flip in that series in Game 6 or Game 7, it would obviously change the conclusions and the things I say in this episode. Those two series are still alive, the 4-5 series. The other thing to keep in mind is that if you are like in the Indiana-Milwaukee series, I apologize in advance. The Indiana-Milwaukee series is a series that I have deliberately not watched a lot of. Snippets here and there. I don't know how many possessions I've seen from the series. It's certainly, if they've played 500 or 600 possessions before the 6-game series that wrapped up this week, it's maybe, let's say, 600 possessions they played in the series. I certainly have not watched 200 possessions of that series. I might have watched 100 possessions of that series. So I don't have, you know, if your guy is on that team, if you're Pascal Siakam or you're Tyrese Halliburton, and you're like, why aren't they on one of your teams? They did all these things that the box score didn't detect. I tip my cap to you. Send me the footage. Send me the message. But I just haven't seen enough between the statistical indicators and the small times I've checked in, small number of times I've checked in on the series. I just haven't seen enough. So, with all that in mind, let's go to. We have Anthony Edwards, we have LeBron James, we have Nikola Jokic. Let's talk about, I want to talk about Jalen Brunson. I said we would get into this Philly series with the Knicks. Jalen Brunson, first 2 games of this series, and we have a video on it, really struggled scoring and shooting and playing this like sort of Allen Iverson level of offensive load where he literally has the highest time of possession by far in the league. He has the ball about half of the time the Knicks have the ball. Let me say that again. He has the ball about half of the time the Knicks have the ball. And if I check our stat boards for Patreon subscribers, just for perspective, LeBron James had the ball 29% of the time in the first round series against the Nuggets. Nikola Jokic had the ball 28% of the time in the first round series against the Nuggets. If you're thinking about other very high ball dominant players, James Harden, Luka Doncic, Anthony Edwards, they're in the low 40s. Brunson's at 50%. So he's doing everything. And they tilted the defense a ton toward him in the first 2 games. I thought he did an okay job of creating for other teammates, meaning he was creating a lot of offense, but I didn't think it was necessarily the greatest dissection of a team throwing that much defensive attention at him. So he has these two games that are kind of struggles at home. Could have very easily been a 1-1 series. And that's another thing to keep in mind. I already alluded to it with the Nuggets-Lakers series. In trying to evaluate a player in a game or a handful of games like this in a series, I really try to think about what the perception would be if a couple shots went the other way, trying to isolate like, okay, yeah, they lost by two, but didn't the player have a great game? Like sometimes players have great games and they win by five and we don't worry that it's a close game. And similarly, if a player is on the court and their team is succeeding, thinking about how the team is succeeding and then separating that from the final result, if they go to the bench for 5 minutes and when they're on the bench, the entire operation falls apart. So we tend to think this is the winning bias that I talk about in Thinking Basketball, the book, so much. We tend to think, oh, these guys, when they played the way you're talking about, Ben, their team still lost in five games. So how is that any good? Well, it's good because when they were on the court, they were succeeding. That's the level of success and performance that we're trying to acknowledge and separate from other players. So in the case of Brunson, it's like those first two games were pretty rough, especially when you compare them to the other players we're talking about here. But then you get into the thing of, in a 6 or 7 game playoff series, is the average the best way to figure out someone's value? And I'm not going to hold anyone hold anyone's feet to the fire if they say, I kind of want to take the averages for a philosophical perspective. Maybe if Cody were here, he'd say, we need to take the average because it's the best way to do things over long samples. I mean, maybe it gets weird if, depending on how short the sample is, we decide we're not going to take the average. So I get it. You can take the average. But for me, when I think about performance in a playoff series, I do think about win probability, like how much are you changing the win probability of the series based on your play? And something happens in modern basketball from game to game in a playoff series where a player can make adjustments, a team can make adjustments, and you can make the argument that there's only like a pseudo break between games. You can say all you're doing is saying game two was bad shooting luck and game three was good shooting luck, and you're creating a narrative out of that. I understand that. But I do think, predictively, when we can point to an actual line of demarcation and say, between game two and game three, this team made these adjustments. This player probably looked at this film. The coaches probably put in these points of emphasis. And then, especially with a player like Jalen Brunson, athletically, intellectually, his nervous system, the way he plays, he started to figure out the beats of how he was being defended to find these little pockets to score. And in the last four games of the series, Brunson averaged, I thought I had a typo here, played 46 minutes a game. Speaking of the Allen Iverson comparison that we talked about in that video, he played 46 minutes a game, averaged 42 points a game on 10 assists per night. 42 points a game on 10 assists per game, 59% true shooting. That's crazy. Brunson actually had this crazy hot stretch at the end of the year in the final 10 games as well. And so if you look at his playoff series and the final 10 games of the season, he's averaged 37 a game in the last 16 games. So yeah, that is an interesting thing to try to philosophically square up. The guy's doing everything. He's a one-man offense. He doesn't have a great offensive team. They do have shooting, though, around him. It's not the greatest shooting team, but Josh Hart has shot very well. DiVincenzo. Now, they lost Bogdanovich, which is a bit of a mini tragedy for me because I think he just adds a little extra punch to the Knicks' offense. We know they don't have Julius Randle, and that's why he's doing so much heavy lifting and taking on all this primacy. But I actually think looking forward, especially beyond the Indiana series coming up, I think looking forward to the Celtics series, in a series like that, a lot of people might have the instinct to say you want Randle as a second outlet valve. I think Randle has struggled enough in the playoffs taking on heavier loads that I'm more interested in seeing another punchier shooter and player like Bogdanovich, but unfortunately, we won't get to see it. Brunson, basically, those first two games were rough. The last four games, so many key shots, pretty good decision-making in terms of creating for others, the craftiness to just constantly make big plays. Yes, there are occasional stretches, and this is why we're not talking about like a runaway MVP top three player, but there are occasional stretches in there where the Knicks would like run the same play over and over again down the stretch, and a couple turnovers. I think game five, he had a couple really bad turnovers, and you just come up empty on a bunch of trips. But otherwise, just a fantastic series for him. Weird thing with this series, though, is that when he was on the court, the Knicks were actually outscored. And that connects to the other guy that I'm going to pencil in here for the final first-team spot, and that's Joel Embiid. This is a weird one because there are certain deficiencies in Embiid's game in this postseason that I think, to me, are fairly glaring compared to what we've seen from his level of play before. And then there are strengths that were somewhat incredible. They were objectively incredible when you think about the fact that he's playing on like one leg, has Bell's palsy, struggling with vision or whatever it is, and then had a migraine, I think, for game five of the series. So just a ton going on where he's sort of out of sorts. So a lot of strengths and weaknesses to try to figure out just based on how he played in the playoffs, which will be a slightly different evaluation than when I do the annual top 10 players and try to say, okay, what level of play did he achieve when he was healthy? And then let's account for the fact that he wasn't healthy at the end of the year. What level of play did he achieve then? I think there aren't many players in the world still, even when, and we'll talk about some of the bumps and inconsistencies he had, even with some of the warts that he displayed in this series, can go out and average 32 points per 75 on positive efficiency. He had the 50-point game. He had a 39-point game. He had a game where, after scoring a lot, he becomes more of the playmaker because the defense tilts more toward him. Then in game six, they start to tilt back a little bit toward Maxey because giving Embiid so much attention helps Maxey. That's where his presence on the court and some of that just latent inherent value that he brings because of his scoring threat, because of what the threat, as I said, of sort of like how he's pressuring defenses. That's the word I'm looking for, Ben, pressuring. There's a decent amount of value in that in a playoff series. And when he goes to the bench, that goes away. Philly finally found some stuff at the end of the series, I think, with small ball lineups and getting Buddy Hield involved. And they finally had, for the first time in six games, they actually had success with Embiid on the bench. It was Embiid's first negative plus minus game of the entire series. So they lost the series in six. But the first five games, when he was on the court, Philly won those minutes in every single game. So Brunson, who we just mentioned, wins the series. The Knicks were outscored with him on the floor. Embiid, they outscore the Knicks by 46 points in the series when he played over the six games. That's 8 points a game. They were 8 points a game that were better than the Knicks when he was on the court, and they still couldn't find a way to win that incredibly close series. So the scoring, the latent value, the gravity that he presents, the way everything can run through him, and that allows the slashers and shooters for the 76ers to sort of be unlocked, for lack of a better word, that goes away when he goes to the bench. I think all that still provided mega value. And then the rim protection, he struggled with agility, he struggled with conditioning, but there were moments in the series where his rim protection was really, really good and dominant for stretches, just multiple contests around the basket. And let me add one more thing. As great as the Knicks are as an offensive rebounding team, and they went crazy in a couple games, including last night with monster offensive rebounding performances, Embiid was still a guy that he didn't have the burst and the agility to maybe go get as many rebounds as you would want, but he was still one of the key rebounding components for Philly in that case. But the passing, some of the decision-making, some of the shot selection, Like there were moments down the stretch of this series where game five, especially game six, they would run pick and roll, Embiid short rolls, Maxey bounces it to him, and he was wide open at the free throw line. And that jumper, that is like a 60% shot for him, especially when he's open. You know, the total number is around 50, but that includes all the fades and the contests and the handful of last second, you know, hot potato shots against the clock. Like when he is open, that shot is ridiculously high percentage shot. It's like a 15-foot layup. And he just wasn't taking them down the stretch of this series in that spot. And then famously in the game earlier in the series that they lost, game four, I think, where he had one on the baseline, up faked, went in, tried to draw the foul, missed the layup instead when they were down by three, and that kind of iced it. So there was that. The passes and the passing improvement that he made in the regular season, there were a handful of them at times in the postseason. I want to say down the stretch of game two, he had an incredibly important pass from the top in a key possession. So there was a little bit of it. But to me, whatever was going on with him physically, the eyesight, the brain, the body, the lack of movement, the lack of trust from the knee, that stuff went away a little bit. And so you're left with this very interesting kind of player. I'll compare back to like a Patrick Ewing kind of player, maybe 1990 Patrick Ewing, but a little bit more and a little bit more richness because of Embiid shooting and Embiid's ability to stretch the court. That 50-point game he just started making, I don't know what was going on there. It was like a video game. He's like, I'm just going to make four or five threes in a row because I feel like it's time. I can't move, but I'll just make four or five threes in a row. So tough call, could be second team. And it's weird because I think it's a decent drop in his play quality from when he was healthy earlier in the year. But when you stack it up to the rest of the league, I think I'll take him fifth or put him on this team with this five. So it's Edwards, Brunson, LeBron James, Joel Embiid, Nikola Jokic. Let's do the second team and then we'll call it a wrap. Let's just stay in this series. Tyrese Maxey, I think I'm going to put him on one of my second team spots here. It's a tough one. There's a couple guys I want to get to that I was considering for the one of the first team spots. Tyrese Maxey, game one, game two, game five, especially game five. Huge games. I thought there were times that he struggled a little bit passing with the extra pressure that they gave him. And of course, he's not a great defender. It wasn't like he had a really outlying excellent defensive series as well. Then the result of that was when they shifted the defense more to him in game six, he struggled. Also think he was fatigued playing big minutes through the overtime in game five, playing big minutes throughout the series. And how do you know if a player's fatigued from the outside other than the fact that they're like huffing and puffing and can't get back? And that wasn't Maxey. He certainly still looked like Tyrese Maxey. It felt like all his shots were short. And so you don't have that same burst. You don't have that same bounciness on your jumper. And a lot of your shots are short. After you play like 45 minutes a game for the series and the series is really intense, to me, that's what fatigue looks like. And that's what I'm speaking to here. So we'll go with Maxey. Let me jump to another series. I mentioned the Clippers and the Mavs. This is a very interesting series. I think on the Clippers side, Paul George in the first four games was pretty clearly the best Clippers player. He had a really bad shooting game in game three. And I don't know, what did he have, like 7 points or something in game three? But in the first two games, his defense was really critical and really good. And it's that kind of defense that we talked about that is hard for people to see as you just casually watch live. But his versatility, the way he can play passing lanes and also protect the rim all at once, I thought was really, really good. Game four, he comes out. Game four is the game where he's just dropping bombs. I don't remember how many threes he had, but he had a huge like 38-point game, made a ton of huge shots, and he was on fire early in the first quarter. The issue with George in this series is he really struggled getting to the basket. So if you look at the tracking data, 9 drives per 36 minutes, that's solid. That's in the 70th percentile in the playoffs in the first round. But then the efficiency, 45% true shooting on his drives, that's close to like bottom third of the league territory for drive efficiency. And I just thought he couldn't really get great separation, really couldn't collapse the defense and pressure them. And so as a result of that, there isn't a ton of playmaking to go with his scoring. So the short of it is his offensive series was, it was left something to be desired. Let's put it that way. James Harden, he's kind of doing the trick-or-treat thing again. I think in the wins and in key moments for the Clippers, he has played that pick-and-roll ball. He's got the step-back working. Game 4, the in-between, the middle game, mid-range, floater, all that was great. Has it been a poor defensive series for him? I think it's actually been a pretty good defensive series for him. I would think of his defense in this series overall maybe around neutral. So it's been a nice series. I don't think either Harden or PG, the totality of that with some of the inconsistencies they've had. Harden had like 7 points in game 5 on 2-for-12. The offense was just completely stuck in the mud for the Clippers. Got to about the second quarter of that game and said to everyone in the group chat that I was talking with, like, this game is on the verge of being over late in the second quarter. It's like a 5-point game because the Clippers cannot generate anything offensively. And it goes back to that last point about Harden and some of the inconsistencies and George and the inability to pressure and touch the paint and create that way. And sure enough, like the next 8-12 minutes of live game action or whatever were just, they're a blowout. I mean, the Mavs completely dominated them. Sometimes you don't get that dominance. The shot quality's there, but one team has a couple extra makes and one team has a couple extra misses. In games when the shot quality is not wonky like that, you get the dam breaking, right? You get that all that pressure that's built up. It's like a great soccer match. You're like, oh, it's 0-0, but it's about to be 2-0 because they can't sustain this. The Clippers can't get good shots, and they can't really take away what the Mavs are doing. And that brings us to the Mavs. And I'm going to have 2 Mavs players on my second team here. Luka, not the greatest shooting series from him. Absolutely want to shout out Terrence Mann and the job that he did. I think if we were trying to do like all defensive players from the first round or something like that, I would very much consider Terrence Mann for a first team spot. Also shout out Lou Dort. What did Lou Dort do to Brandon Ingram, and can he do that to potentially Luka Doncic in a second round matchup? They matched up the last time they had a meaningful game, the Thunder and the Mavs, that is. Dort did guard Luka. Obviously, Luka has the size to shoot over. My dad, I think Luka's just going to do Luka things. But when you consider the other stuff, the ball denial, pushing the catches out high, getting around the screen, I'm fascinated to see that. So more shout-outs to defensive guys. Lou Dort here, just amazing first round against Brandon Ingram and the Pelicans. But in this series, the shooting aside, even with how well Mann and some of the Clippers have defended Dallas in the first game and in other moments of this series, and you look at Luka's stat line and you say, like, okay, 28 points per 75, minus 4% true shooting, that's not that good. What's going on there? Goes back to latent value. And in Luka's case, it's even a little bit more explicit because the passing has still been really, really good. The passing at times has just been splendid, just like chef's kiss. I'm snaking into the paint. I know how you're going to defend me. I want to go at my own tempo. Zubats is there. Man's on my hip. There's a third defender on the block. He's deciding whether he needs to help. Derek Lively's in a little bit of a roll situation. Oh, you gave me a 3-foot by 3-foot window to throw the ball up to right next to the rim for a Derek Lively lob. I'm going to hit that like 3 out of 5 possessions. The other 2 possessions, I'm going to make a step back or I'm going to swing it and skip it to a shooter, and Derek Jones is going to drop a 3 from the corner. I think for a good portion of this series, Luka has had that going. And to a certain degree, his overall playmaking and floor game have kept his offensive value at a really high place for me. despite the low shooting numbers. And then defensively, I think it's the best defense I've ever seen him play. I think defensively in this series, now, would I describe it as good? I would say it's solid, because you have to remember there are moments where, like, he picks up, I think it's game four, he picks up two fouls in game four early in the game, and then he's just like a matador in front of James Harden every time James Harden has the ball. He's like, James, here you go. Please, please go by me. I think I lost track of the number of blow-bys in that particular game. So analyzing it within the context of a one game, a one series against one opponent, I would say it was solid defense. But the physicality, the activity, couple shot blocking moments with some stuff around the rim. We saw that in the regular season. That's coming through here. I just love the toughness that the Mavs have shown here, and he's been part of that. And so no, I wouldn't call this like negative defense in this series. I think his defense has been pretty solid. He was maybe the toughest cut for first team. It felt fitting though to kind of capture some of the struggles and the dynamic of the series to have him and Kyrie Irving on the same line. Because there were actual moments in the series where Kyrie Irving's defense was like legitimately good perimeter defense. Game two, I think, was the best defensive game I've ever seen him play. He was disruptive. He was quick. Some weak side zones and reads rotating that were just phenomenal, like the quickness and then the hands, some activity with the hands. I don't know what the final steal numbers were for him or deflections. I don't have them up in front of me, but impressive moments for him defensively in what is a sort of defensively grinded out series. I mentioned the sort of context of what it means to have a player's stats and then put that in perspective with the team results. Kawhi Leonard is not really there for the series. When he plays, he probably hurts the Clippers with his on-court minutes. They lose those games. He sits in the first and fourth game. Clippers win. This feels like a bit of an underperformance for the Mavs against that team. But with Luka on the court, they've been plus 13 per 100. A decent amount of that, I think, is coming from the blowout in game five. But in general, they have, I think, won every single game, won Luka's minutes in every single game in the series. Massive plus minus for him again in the playoffs compared to the regular season. So when he's out there, I feel like the Mavs shot quality has been good. I feel like they've certainly had good defensive moments. And just to have it on record, his plus minus in the games in order, plus 3, plus 8, plus 11, plus 10, plus 28. And to some degree, that's what the series has felt like. It's felt like Dallas and Doncic kind of slowly figuring out what the Clippers are trying to do and then exerting their talent advantage. Why do they have that talent advantage? Kyrie Irving. Kyrie Irving, off ball, the speed of his actions, the shooting. And an interesting thing happened. He had the huge game four. And in game five, the Clippers came back and gave him a little bit more defensive attention. Hey, we're going to try to stick Terrence Mann on you for a little bit or whatever it is. And now all of a sudden, life gets a little bit easier for Luka. Luka basically has his best offensive game of the series. He finishes that game with 35 points, 14 of 26 from the floor, second straight game with 10 assists. So it's fitting to me that these guys were kind of on the same line. So what is that? Tyrese Maxey, Kyrie Irving, Luka Doncic. Here's another one I struggled with whether to go on the first team. So Luka's a guy, I think you can make an argument for a first team. The seventh guy that was tough for me was Anthony Davis. And we talked about this last episode, so I won't belabor the point here. But I think Anthony Davis played really well. Like, if I had to sort of objectively evaluate his talent, I think I can make an argument that he goes on the first team. Maybe you bump Embiid down to the second team, something like that. I don't know. But against the Nuggets, I'm not sure how valuable it is. I'm not sure how effective some of those tools are. So, yeah, he kind of toes the line for me. Again, hitting his mid-range shot all of a sudden just because it's the playoffs, I don't know how he does that. Great offensive series just as a finisher, but not as a playmaker. Good defense, but the defense doesn't seem to totally derail what the Nuggets do. I'm comfortable with AD as a second-team all-performance. And that leaves one slot left. at least one slot left. I mentioned Paul George. I mentioned James Harden. Some other candidates to think about here. Damian Lillard. Really weird series. He had a huge game one. Struggled in game three. Missed game four and five. Had defensive issues at times, obviously. I think it's just too much. I think it's too many negative games, too many missed games. You missed two games in a six-game series. It's too much. Again, apologies to Siakam and Halliburton if anyone wants to slot them there. Rudy Gobert, his defensive presence, is that enough to say you were one of the roughly 10 best players of the first round? I don't know. I don't think so. Don't love his offensive series. I think his offensive series is kind of a negative. What about one of his teammates, Karl-Anthony Towns? Karl-Anthony Towns had a pretty big offensive series from kind of like a secondary perspective. I know in our model, he had one of the best offensive box plus minuses of the first round. Averaged 26 points per 75 on plus 11% true shooting. I thought his decision-making was a little bit better throughout the series, or certainly the stretches of the series that I saw. That's close for him as well. I think he could possibly get that spot. Devin Booker had one big game at the end of the Suns series. Didn't love Kevin Durant's defense and passing and playmaking. A lot of turnovers, struggled with the physicality of that series. So I don't think any of those guys really played at what I would consider like an all-NBA, all-NBA second team-ish level, which is roughly where we need to be to get on this first-round all-NBA second team here. Let me shout out one more guy first. Michael Porter Jr. had a really good series. We talked about it last time. Defense has been better. Shot making has been ridiculous. He's basically a pure finisher, so almost no playmaking passing. Has a little bit of gravity and spacing effect. I think that's good. I think you can argue Michael Porter Jr. just authored an all-star quality series. Again, does that get you to this level? I'm not sure. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is the tough one because they were in kind of like a dogfight. It was a very defensively driven series. And so when you have a defensively driven playoff series, maybe the game is consistently officiated a little bit more physically. Everyone's numbers shift down. So you could be Shai and you could outscore, you know, the opponent when you're on the court by a healthy number, 16 points per 100 in the first round. But then you look at that and you go, okay, what was the team's offensive rating when he was on the floor? It's 109. That's terrible. So you're like playing in a different era. You're comparing stats from like a different era. You're like, they dominated, but the offensive stats, because the average offensive rating is 109, are not going to be as plentiful going around. You know, Jalen Williams maybe has nice offensive stats, but Shai, -3 true shooting percentage in the series. His turnovers and his turnover economy was pretty good. I should have mentioned that with Luka, by the way. Luka's turnover economy was very good in the first round to offset some of that. If you do the box score glance and you say, like, he didn't shoot very well. They did defend him well, but part of that decision-making and that passing is that the turnover economy was there. Shai is right on the line. Not sure. You know, I think everyone in OKC collectively played well as a team. No one really played great. And then defensively, I thought they all played really well. I thought you had that and the combination of depths and lineups and sort of the way they succeed on offense and defense. So Shai is maybe the toughest guy, but I'm not going to give it to him. I think I got to take a Boston Celtic here. They did play, as I said, the weakest team. I think I have to give it to Derek White over Jason Tatum. Derek White's first round series was crazy. Like He completely dominated. I think it was game four. He just completely took over the game for the middle of the game on offense and defense. Had like 38 points, three blocks, seven or eight threes. And he's pretty consistent in what I saw from that series. That was another series I didn't deep scout all four games of that series, but just constantly checking in on it. Derek White, I think, was the best Celtic in the series. Let's not sleep on how good he is, because it's kind of like a peak vintage Drew Holiday series. If you look at game two when they lost, he only had 13 points. But the rest of the time, big scoring series from him. Defensively, there's possessions, there's stretches where he guards Bam Adebayo, and then on the next possession guards Tyler Hero, and then on the next possession guards Jaime Jaquez, and does a great job against all of them. Bam and Jaime, he has to use strength in the post. Hero, he has to chase around the screen and block the three from behind. And of course, we know how good of a shot-blocking guard he is. So it's a tough one because I think the opponent quality isn't necessarily there. The opponent quality isn't necessarily there for the OKC guys either. And then the primacy. He doesn't really exist as the same kind of primary centric force as Jason Tatum. But I didn't think Jason Tatum had a particularly good series as a primary offensive force. I've seen a lot of his offensive possessions. There's a lot of isolation, a lot of kind of stagnant stuff. Made some nice passes, but I feel like I would want that to be better compared to, I'll be a little bit more results oriented here trying to pick this final slot, because I think it's nice to catalog A, how good Derek White has been for the team all season. B, how good Derek White objectively is. Like, he's a really good player. JJ Redick's push for him to make the All-Star team in midseason was not just some random, like, hey, this guy is on a 65-win team. He needs to make... No, like, Derek White's really good. He's really, really good. And then finally, in this series, to average... Here are the numbers. 26 points per 75 on plus 17% true shooting. Shot 59% on a handful of mid-range shots. Shot 70% on his drives. It's not quite as dynamically offensively centric as I would love, but I thought it was a really good series from Derek White. So that's it. First team is Anthony Edwards, Jalen Brunson, LeBron James, Joel Embiid, Nikola Jokic. Second team is Tyrese Maxey, Kyrie Irving, Derek White, Luka Doncic, Anthony Davis. We got all kinds of honorable mentions. Thanks as always for listening to this one. If you want to support us, patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. That's the way to do it. That's where you can also check out our playoff stats board that we have up live that updates daily for the rest of the postseason. Whew, that was a lot of talking. We will be back shortly to discuss the second round with Cody. In the meantime, hope you're enjoying the playoffs. Hope you enjoy the weekend and that you're having a great day.